This talk is a little different. I think this is something a couple of the talks in this session have in common, in that we're not talking about traditional general purpose computers hooked up to the internet. What I'm going to talk about instead is a system called APCO Project 25. APCO Project 25 is essentially a digital radio system that has been in progress since the early 1990s. Products have been out since the early 2000s, intended to be a replacement for the two-way radio systems used by public safety agencies in the United States, using narrowband VHF and UHF channels. It is at this point widely fielded among the federal government and fielded as well among many state and local agencies. The Philadelphia Police Department, for example, my hometown uses P25. Some local agencies don't, like the New York Police Department. They haven't switched over yet. But the federal government at this point is the dominant user. It's in use in a few other countries as well, and it is very, very widely deployed, mandatory among federal users because of some requirements for going to narrowband and for interoperability. It is a heavily constrained problem because it's a digital system that's intended to be transitionally compatible with the analog systems it replaces. That is, it uses the same RF spectrum management scheme, the same narrowband channels, and in fact, the radios have to be capable of switching from analog to digital mode as in their configuration. There's a fairly wide range of equipment available from a number of different brands. They have walkie-talkie radios, handheld handsets. They have mobile radios. They have base radios. And there's infrastructure ranging from simple point-to-point systems, one radio talks to another within range, to repeater systems, to trunked radio systems, which are these centrally managed dynamic spectral allocation schemes that are used for some very large systems. But it can be used to replace all of the different kinds of infrastructure that existed in the analog world. There are a few vendors. Motorola is probably the dominant vendor, and in fact, there's quite a bit of patent cross-licensing and technology cross-licensing, so there's a fairly small actual underlying technology base for the implementations, as well as the standard itself. To give you an idea of the range of implementations, I went looking for pictures of P25 equipment. Here's an example on the left of the Department of Defense user holding one of the P25 walkie-talkies. They use them in war zones. It's also used by the Department of Justice, the Department of Homeland Security for law enforcement, surveillance, and so on, as well as executive protection. That's an official White House photo of the back of a Secret Service agent at a formal event. The thing at the end of the little coiled earpiece is a P25 walkie-talkie. So how does this work? Well, the voice protocol is very simple. I'm not going to go over it in great detail. It basically runs at 9,600 bits per second over the air, two bits per symbol at 4,800 symbols per second, using for the voice protocol a vocoder called IMBE, which gives reasonable speech quality at that bit rate. Essentially, a voice transmission is a train of 180 millisecond long IMBE encoded frames. There's a header at the beginning and a trailer at the end, but really the meat of it is this series of these 180 millisecond, 1728 bit long frames that are repeated one after the other. And there's some technical details that there are two different kinds of frames, but they're not important for our purposes of our conversation. Now, it's a broadcast-oriented protocol. All transmissions are effectively one-way, even though it's a two-way radio system. The sender makes all the decisions. There are no sessions. There's no two-way negotiation going on. Essentially, everybody is multicasting to a multicast group in a one-way fashion. There are no ACKs. And it uses, the only error correction is the use of error correction, forward error correction codes. There's no ACKs and NACs and retransmissions because it's a real-time voice protocol. So the latency is supposed to be no more than one voice frame, so there's no way to retransmit and so on. Now, this is used for purposes not just for local police dispatch, so some of them require security, and so the P25 standard includes optional security features. Symmetric encryption is used for the protection of voice, and it specifies a few ciphers, AES being the dominant one used today. It also supports the use of type 1 NSA crypto as well. With crypto hardware modules installed in the radios. The keying model is that the traffic keys have to be loaded in advance. There's no key negotiation between peers or anything like that. There's a provision to load keys manually with a key loading device into the radio, and there's also an over-the-air keying protocol that you can use to re-key radios through the infrastructure. Now, there are two important properties of the way the security model works that will turn out to be important to us. The first is that messages sent in the clear on the frequency that the radio is tuned to are always demodulated and played over the speaker, and messages sent in the encrypted mode are always played if it can find the correct key to play them. That is to say, the state of your encryption has nothing to do with whether you will decrypt audio or play clear audio. The sender's radio makes decisions about what it will do, but receivers will attempt to play anything that they can play. And that will turn out to be a very important decision for us later down the road. Okay, so what did we do? Well, we examined the protocols and we examined the implementations. There's a lot of stuff in the paper. I'll give you the kind of rough highlights. The first problem is a certificational one. It's an ad hoc design. There are no formal security requirements in the standard, so we can't really judge the standard about whether it's meeting them because it hasn't actually told us what it's trying to accomplish, which from a crypto point of view is a worrisome sign. But at least the traffic encryption we found is not broken in any obvious ways. There are certificational weaknesses, there's a few worrisome things in there, but they're not doing anything like, you know, sending the key as the first, you know, instead of the initialization vector or any of the other mistakes that occasionally people make. But it does suffer some protocol weaknesses. There's no authentication, it's encryption only, and we know that that can be used to leverage various kinds of attacks. It's susceptible to particularly nasty forms of traffic analysis, and both active and passive, and it is the most vulnerable to denial of service to jamming radio protocol I've ever encountered. It gives an enormous advantage to the attacker. It is easier to attack a system than to send a legitimate signal. And there are some serious crypto usability weaknesses. So I'm going to talk about these things right now. So let's look at some attacks. First, I'd like to talk about is traffic analysis. Every transmission includes a unique user ID, a unit ID, a talk group ID that the message is intended for, and something called a network access code. And that's sent along with every transmission, and it's necessary because of the architecture of P25 for every transmission to have these things as metadata sent out with them. Effectively, the unit ID is, in most systems, unique to each radio if they are using encryption, because the over-the-air rekeying protocol uses it to index the radios. So, in fact, within the federal government, it effectively uniquely identifies every radio, every agency, and the agency that it belongs to. Now, the standard supports encryption of the unit ID, but when it's sent over the air when you're in encrypted mode, but we discovered that actually it's not encrypted. When the encryption is turned on, none of the current products actually encrypt it. It just sends it in the clear. And we were a little surprised by that, and we think, as improbable as that may be, we may be the first people to have looked to see whether it's actually sending it in the clear. So all the encrypted unit IDs are actually going out in the clear. So that was worrisome. But you have to be transmitting in order to see that. There's another attack possible by the fact that if you're using the over-the-air rekeying protocol or any of the messaging functions of P25, radios will respond to specially malformed packets that act as pings directed to a particular unit ID. And they'll respond with a message back saying, that was a malformed packet, please resend it in the data protocol. So you can address any radio even when it's idle, as long as it's on and within range, and it will respond to your ping with a transmission that says, hey, I am here, effectively, even though it's actually telling you I didn't understand what you said. And that's transparent to the user of the pinged radio. So we've got this scenario, the marauder's map, we're calling it, and I owe Margot Seltzer pointing out that that's from Harry Potter. I thought I'd made that name up myself. The ping response is sufficient to allow automated direction finding of the radios with two bases at fixed locations. It's a long enough transmission, and phased antenna arrays, and you essentially can very easily build an infrastructure that lets you create a real-time map of whatever radios you're looking for, even when they're idle. Now, in the public safety scenario, that may not be a very serious problem, but in the military context where these radios are being used, that's actually a very serious vulnerability. And in fact, in the surveillance context, even domestically, that's a potentially serious vulnerability. Okay, so that was an example of one of the attacks we found. Another attack we found is that these radios are uniquely vulnerable to denial of service. P25 uses aggressive error correction code. And from the denial of service point of view, that should be very good news, because that means you have to jam enough to overcome the error correction code, not just jam individual bits of a transmission. But the error correction codes are calculated over small subfields of the transmission in particular cases, and individual subfields are essentially error corrected separately. And so an adversary has an easier job than jamming and all of the bits that are sent over the air. An adversary can select a single subfield to jam within the frame. Now, it turns out there's a 64-bit frame in every 1728-bit voice frame that tells you how to interpret this as a voice frame. And it's sufficient to attack just those 64 bits or 32 symbols. Now that turns out to be, that represents, if you do the calculation, 14 dB less energy, 14 decibels less energy for the attacker than for the legitimate users, which is the opposite of what we normally try to achieve in digital radio systems like spread spectrum. Spread spectrum systems tend to have a 14 dB number, but it's positive rather than negative. In the energy relationship. So that's bad in theory. So one question is, well, that might require a lot of synchronization. That might be very hard to do. How hard is that to do in practice? Is it practical to jam a P25 system using the subframe technique? It turns out, yeah, that's practical. So it turns out there's a chip made by TI, the CC1110, which is a single chip digital radio transceiver used in consumer products. It costs a few bucks in quantity. It's used in a wide variety of small radio telemetry applications. And it turns out to be near the federal band spectrum that it operates in, and has the capability to, versions of the chip have the capability to operate in all of the same frequencies that P25 radios use. And it turns out its native protocol is very similar in the way it does synchronization to P25. In fact, it's sufficiently close that it can be convinced to recognize the beginnings of P25 frames. And it turns out also to be used in consumer products that in small quantities are actually cheaper than buying the chips, but include the power supply and the battery and things like that. So we found a $15, actually it's two for $30 device called a GirlTech IMME, which is a little instant messenger. It has a unicorn on the box. It's aimed at preteen girls. We developed our own P25 jamming firmware. And by we, I mean Travis. So we're calling it the My First Jammer, and it turns out to work work entirely effectively. You'd have to add an outboard power amplifier if you wanted to use this to actually jam in the real world, and actually the power amplifier would be, you know, a couple times more expensive than the actual jammer itself and the antenna and the cables. But its battery life would be effectively infinite because you're using an enormous amount less power than the real one. But that's not actually the interesting thing, because there you're only brute force jamming every transmission. The more interesting scenario is to try to alter the behavior of the people you're jamming. And the jammer has the advantage of being low duty cycle. It's spending most of its time in receive mode. And so it can be programmed to process the traffic it's receiving. And one of the things that we thought was interesting to program it to do is look for messages that have the bit on that say this is encrypted. And so if you programmed a device like this to only jam encrypted traffic, you can force your adversary to switch over to the clear in order to be able to communicate. And in fact, if usability problems with the crypto mean that users are accustomed to their encryption not working, they may never notice this and may just attribute this to being kind of normal, par for the course operation. So that leads us to the question, well, how usable is crypto in practice? Now, that's not actually the null set. That turns out that logo, which is on my shirt and on the radios, is the encryption symbol, although you are among the only people who know that now. So these radios, we notice, have a number of potential usability problems. They give very poor feedback about the crypto state. I mentioned earlier that the crypto switch only controls what the transmitter does. It doesn't control what the receiver does. And therefore, encrypted and unencrypted users can inadvertently be mixed in with each other. And they'll never know that somebody has their crypto switch off if everybody has the correct key material. One or more users can be unencrypted, and everything will just work fine as far as they're concerned, but anyone can listen. The second problem is that there's frequent rekeying and an unreliable rekey protocol. The over-the-air rekeying protocol is unreliable for a number of reasons that we discuss in the paper, and many agencies have been told, use short-lived keys because they're more secure. Change your keys often, because that's good cryptographic practice. So we've heard about the poor crypto feedback. If you go back to this conference 12 years ago, Witten and Tigar's Why Johnny Can't Encrypt paper talked about giving good feedback to the user. And we're seeing that that lesson was apparently not learned in the design of P25. So I'll show you a picture. Here's the Motorola P25 walkie-talkie radio. Here it is in clear mode. You can look at the top of the radio in the display, and here it is in secure mode, and as you can tell, they're completely different and easy to tell apart. There's also no easy way, if a radio is unkeyed, to key it in the field. It's designed deliberately to use centrally managed keys, either with the over-the-air rekeying protocol or with a key loading device, which is actually larger than the handheld radios, that is locked up in a safe somewhere that you can load the keys into the radio through its accessory port. So if a single user doesn't have the key, the only practical alternative is for them to go into the clear mode. So one question we asked is, given these usability failures, and given the difficulty of rekeying the radios, how much clear text is out there? So, you know, Bob Morris, in his invited talk at Crypto 95, gave the first NSA's first rule of cryptanalysis. First, look for clear text. So that's just what we did. You know, we talked about a couple of attacks against this, the Marauder's Map, the subframe jamming. They're active attacks. You know, we could figure out how to carry them out, but at least that raises the bar a little bit. Just sending your traffic in the clear does not have a very high bar for the attacker. All you have to do is listen for it. And we discovered that actually there's a significant volume of clear text out there today that's sent unintentionally. And we discovered that by accident. So last year when we started playing with these radios, we got one of the frequencies that we programmed into the radio off by 10 megahertz by accident and heard this surveillance operation going on. sounded very James Bondish. And I thought, gee, that's interesting. I wonder what that is. So we started looking at the federal spectrum where tactical law enforcement surveillance takes place. So not police dispatch radios, but the actual tactical confidential federal surveillance, you know, agents of following people around, takedown, SWAT operations, executive protection, and so on. And we omitted all of the non-sensitive frequencies, uniformed patrols, the Park Service, no offense to the Park Service, and so on. And we sampled the traffic that we saw. And we set up a network. We kind of created our own little mini NSA. We got a bunch of receivers. We looked at the 2,000 discrete VHF and UHF voice channels allocated to the federal government. And what we did was very simple. We looked for the ones that had encrypted traffic on them. And we focused on those. And we did this in two cities that I won't mention. We then allocated a number of P25 scanning receivers that are software programmable. We used the ICOM R2500, which is a little bit pricey, but it met our particular needs for being able to record traffic statistics. Kept this running for a while. And what we found was that, in fact, most tactical law enforcement traffic is successfully encrypted. But there's over 20 minutes mean per day of really sensitive clear text that just goes out in the clear without users' apparent knowledge. And you know, there's a higher during the week, lower on weekends and holidays, but it's solidly an average of a little over 20 minutes per day per city of unintended clear text. Well, how sensitive are we talking about? The most sensitive stuff they have, you know, names of informants and plans for operations and takedowns and identities of undercover operatives and so on. So what's going wrong here? Well, we found, just as we might have predicted, that there are two reasons that this happens. One reason is either an individual user or sometimes an entire group, everybody, has their crypto switch in the wrong position, and it's just never detected. And the other reason is that the over-the-air rekeying protocol has left somebody without a key, and they've been forced to go out into the clear. And we found that it's roughly half the time for each. You know, roughly half the time it's either a undetected switch in the wrong position, and the other half of the time it's somebody didn't have a key, and so everybody has to go back into the clear. So, you know, our kind of observation here is this is a widely deployed system. It's been in use for about 10 years. It's intended specifically to provide security as one of its basic features, and yet there's an enormous amount of unintended clear text that's worse than the unencrypted systems they had before because the users believe it to be encrypted and make no effort to hide anything about what they're doing. They regard it as a secure system and rely on it. So there's accidental clear text and keying failure that we find are accounting for this in practice. And exploiting this can be done entirely passively with no risk and with legally obtainable equipment. So, you know, in the long term, the P25 protocols are kind of hopelessly broken. But, you know, that in the short term, that's a small comfort. Saying, well, we're going to have to redesign it and start from scratch is fun from the point of view of security researchers, but there's a large base of equipment out there. So we've identified a number of mitigation strategies that we are suggesting to law enforcement. We've been working with the federal government to try to roll out a number of ways to make the radios more usable within the configuration limits that they currently have. So In particular, we're recommending that the crypto switch be disabled and instead crypto be always on or always off on a channel. And if they want to have both be available, have two channels, one an encrypted version and another an unencrypted version. And we found some tricks that allow you to prevent audio from one from mixing with audio from the other. So that will give better feedback to the user about whether crypto is on. And the second, and this is a bit of a harder sell, is to try to dispel the myth that it's very important to change your keys often. I mean, this was true in World War II. You know, it served the Allied and Axis forces well to rekey frequently when their Enigma machines were broken. But, you know, AES is designed to handle a large amount of traffic. And captured radios are not a significant problem. So one of the things that we're encouraging as well is to move away from this over-the-air rekeying protocol and move to longer-lived keys. So I think that pretty close to exhausts my time. So thank you. I don't know, do we have time for questions?
Rick Farrow. So, Matt, I was wondering whether the government actually funded you getting the first P25 radios, or is this something you did on your own?
Well, you know, it kind of started out informally, and then we realized it was, you know, it started out as an accident, and then we turned it into a research problem. It turns out I'm funded to look at telecommunication security, and this actually fits into that, but it was an accident that I actually started doing what they funded me for.
Very good. Thanks.
Ed Gould, Ed. And one real question. The nit is, you used the word transparent to describe one of the functions of the radio. It seems to me that that's actually invisible to the users, and they can't even tell that it happened, rather than being
Well, they
can notice.
If they've stuck their finger in the antenna jack. They'll get a
well,
burn.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
But one thing that was a little unclear to me, I couldn't tell if the whole infrastructure is so badly broken that we really ought to just toss it out, or if just the design of the usability of the radios is so bad.
Well, there are two. The passive attacks are entirely usability issues. You can eliminate the passive attacks with better usability. The active attacks, which, you know, it's a judgment question as to whether they are worth abandoning the system for, architectural and essentially impossible to get rid of.
Hi. I know you mentioned that when you were listening on these channels, you ended up with a lot of confidential data. Is there anything you can tell us about how you had to deal with it and dispose it off?
We forget it quickly. I mean, we have no desire to be disruptive to, I mean, literally, we're talking about things that could get people harmed.
So when you started mentioning this problem to people, were they in general receptive to it, or were you viewed as the bad guy for discovering it?
Well, I mean, you know, we very politely approached the federal government with, you know, a certain amount of trepidation that they would think that we might be the problem. And in fact, everybody we spoke to, you know, is just like us and understands that, you know, discovering an attack is not the same thing as attacking. Right? So,
the attacks you mentioned, is there any way to post facto discover by logging or any kind of auditing if people have been turning on and off the encryption? And would that be one of your recommendations so that they can analyze?
Some systems do centralized logging, but a lot of these are tactical point-to-point radio systems that don't. So, you know, it depends on the particular system. Some of them do logging. There is the capability in some of the commercial systems to log everything that goes through the repeater. And whether that's actually enabled and whether that's actually where the traffic is, you know, highly dependent on the particular circumstances.
Well, even when they're just being rekeyed, if they go back to the mothership, that'd be an opportunity to download the logs.
The radios don't have logs.
Yeah.
No, they don't.
No logs at all?
No, the radios themselves don't.
So you mentioned that there are three reasons why the users are transmitting plain text. Mm-hmm. How do you distinguish between the three? Did you talk to the users, or did you find it out by passive listening?
So we based it on context. So we knew that any time there was mixed clear and ciphertext, that was a switch in the wrong position. And we assumed that cases where they were in the clear, but it was sensitive, there were often references to rekeying, and it failed. And so we attributed those to rekey failures. Essentially, we used it based on the, you know, what was said over the air.
What about the third case? You said somebody didn't have the...
in a few cases we heard opposite instructions. All right, everybody go to encrypted mode. That's the circle without the line through it. But that's actually the opposite. And so those are the group error ones. And we lumped those together with the individual error.
Did you look at the security of the keying device or the accessory port?
No, but the but you know, you can look at the standard and tell that it's not, you know, the keying device's job is to emit keys, so it, you know, it's not secure. There's no encryption of the keys in the keying device in the basic scenario. And the hardware itself is supposed to be FIPS 140 compliant, and we didn't particularly reverse engineer it.
Very good.
Okay, thanks.